Welcome to the Malefactors Register podcast. In this episode we present the true stories of three unsolved murders from across the United States. The first story, Phantom of the Opera, examines the murder of Metropolitan Opera tenor George Garros in Atlanta in the late 1940s. Our second tale, Unlucky, is the tragic story of a mother and daughter slain as they drove through Texas during the final days of the Depression. Our last story is a Tinseltown murder, the mysterious unsolved killing of a Hollywood canteen hostess during the Second World War.
John Garros was murdered in Atlanta while on a nationwide tour with a New York Metropolitan Opera Company. Police frequently made oblique references to the sexual undercurrents that ran through the case like a subplot of a tragic opera. The 36-year-old Garros was a refugee from Hitler's Germany when he came to the United States in 1941. The child of a Frankfurt opera performer, Garros was a musical prodigy, but spent the early part of his brief life as a conductor, recitalist, and accompanist for Italian and German singers. Unlike most opera performers who train exclusively as singers, Garros demonstrated his innate talent by not taking his first professional lesson until after he was hired as a tenor for the Met in the early 1940s. By 1947 Garros was singing leads in such operas as Mignon and Otello. Opera fans can still buy a recording of Romeo and Juliet that Garros made with maestro Arturo Toscanini. Under the surface could be sensed an inborn purely musical consciousness for transcending what was demanded of it by the medium of expression being employed, wrote one reviewer. One has the impression that Garros never revealed all of which he was capable as an artist. A weak chain of circumstantial evidence hints that there was more under the surface than just Garros's talent as a performer. In fleeing Nazi Germany, Garros left behind his fiancée and made his way to Greece with her brother. His betrothed subsequently died in a concentration camp. When the Nazis moved into Greece, Garros and his friend, Lutz Peter, made their way to the United States where Garros earned a job with the Met and Peter, by this time his housemate, became his performance coach. In the mid-1940s, a man who gave his name as John Garros and who listed the Garros and Peter apartment on West 57th Street in Manhattan as his address was arrested for loitering in the men's room at a nearby subway station. Garros pleaded guilty and his sentence was suspended. Although the artistic community at the time might have been accepting of gay performers, few ever stepped out of the closet, so any assumption about Garros's sexual preferences is merely speculative. The only reason Garros's sexuality is relevant to his death is that police speculated that it may have been a clandestine sexual rendezvous that led to his murder. His body was found prone in a dirty Atlanta alley, and despite the cool, rainy weather that April night in 1949, Garros's coat and hat were found folded neatly some distance from his body. His corpse had been arranged, although it wasn't overtly posed and was placed with care. He lay with his hands folded across his chest and his ankles crossed. There is every indication that this was a jealousy killing and it had the feminine touch, said lead detective Michael Coppinger. The body had apparently been tenderly placed in the alley where it was found. Garros had not been robbed. His wallet was filled with cash and he still wore his wristwatch. The tenor had been shot while he was kneeling before his killer. His left arm was raised and the bullet entered underneath his upraised arm and into his heart. He was shot once, on the left side, the doctor at the scene said. Authorities could tell he was kneeling on his right knee because cinders like those on the ground in the alley were found only on that section of his trousers. The Met Opera troupe had finished a three-day run in Atlanta and was scheduled to take an overnight train to Memphis, the night Garris died. He did not perform that night, but did have dinner with friends and then attended the opera. He had checked out of the Biltmore Hotel at 6 o'clock and shortly after he telephoned the Atlanta YMCA, where several members of the opera crew were staying. Police were never able to identify who Garris called there. "John and I dined with Mrs. Albert E. Meyer and then went to hear the opera," says Harter Glaze, a member of the company. "Mrs. Meyer drove us to the station. I went right to bed and didn't see John again." The special train for the opera company was scheduled to leave at 4:30 a.m. after the Met crew struck the stage and packed up their props and costumes. Garris checked in on the train. His ticket to Memphis had already been punched and was found, along with his musician's union card and passport, in his wallet. The ticket revealed that he had been on the train around midnight. Investigators learned from the cast and crew that when it was revealed that the train would not leave until 4:30, several people, including Garris, decided to head back into town to get something to eat. One witness interviewed by police said the taxi was too crowded and Garris volunteered to walk. He never showed up at the restaurant. A porter on the train, however, said Garris told him after checking his bags that he was going to the Robert Fulton Hotel to play cards. Friends said Garris never played cards. The only hard evidence police had wasn't much help. A .38 steel-jacketed slug was removed from Garris's body. A dispute between local and federal officials about its source became central to the case when an ex-con who admitted he was in Atlanta on the night of Garris's murder was arrested in South Carolina carrying a Belgian-made .38 Nagant revolver with cartridges of the same make as the one that killed Garris. The ex-con, Grover Togo Pulleyde, was a paroled cop killer turned burglar who carjacked a driver in Atlanta and forced him to drive to South Carolina where he was caught. The Clinton, South Carolina detective who questioned Pulleyde also made reference to the sexual undercurrent when he felt it necessary to tell the press that Pulleyde had definite homosexual tendencies. When the Atlanta crime lab test fired Pulleyde's handgun, ballistics experts presumptively linked the murder bullet to Pulleyde's gun. However, the FBI also fired the gun and refused to link the two because the slug taken from Garris was too misshapen to draw any conclusions. Detective Coppinger threw more fuel on the fire surrounding Garris's death when he said his investigation was centering around a possibility that sexual perversion may have been involved in the crime. "There are many reports of unnatural sexual activities," Coppinger told the press. "Naturally, we are checking that angle." For weeks, Coppinger became like another member of the Met troupe, following the touring company from Memphis to Dallas and then to Los Angeles. He continually questioned performers and crew members, including interrogations held between acts during performances. The sexual angle was played up again when police let it be known that they were searching for an unnamed male companion who frequently traveled with Garris. This theory was bolstered by Garris's reservation of a room in Dallas that had two twin beds. Eventually, Coppinger gave up on that angle when no companion could be found and Lutz Peter said there was no such person in Garris's life. Peter, who was in California at the time of the murder, scoffed at the idea that anyone other than him would be traveling with his roommate. "I would have been his only companion and I was in Los Angeles," Peter said. In July 1949, the Fulton County, Georgia, coroner's jury recommended that Pulleyde be charged with Garris's murder. The jurors made their decision based on testimony from the Fulton County criminalists who rejected the FBI analysis of the handgun found on Pulleyde. No one from the FBI testified. Pulleyde was never indicted for the slaying of Garris. With only a weak ballistics link to the murder, the case would have been very difficult to prosecute. Pulleyde was the only person ever named as a suspect in a case that remains unsolved. Unlucky. Western Front probably thought good luck was responsible for his winning a shiny new 1938 Packard in a community chess raffle. How else could he explain spending 50 cents on a ticket and driving away with a luxury car? There was luck attached to the Packard, but it wasn't the kind Fromm expected, and he probably went to his grave cursing the day he won the auto. Fromm was a well-to-do Berkeley manufacturing executive with a loving wife and family when he won the Packard in a Delaware raffle. Because he didn't need the car, he gave it to his 23-year-old daughter, Nancy, who had recently graduated from college. When Nancy decided to take a cross-country trip to visit a sister who lived back east in Parris Island, South Carolina, she had first planned to make the trip by herself by train. Her mother, Hazel, however, was concerned that Nancy would not be safe on the long trip. Instead, they decided to travel together taking the new Packard. Hazel and Nancy were experienced travelers who enjoyed taking long motor trips and seeing the sights along the way. Bidding Western goodbye in Berkeley in late March 1938, the women first headed south along the California coastline until they reached San Diego. Then they took US 80, the road then known as the Broadway of America, which ran across the southern United States from California to Georgia. The trip was uneventful until they reached El Paso, Texas, where the Packard apparently developed some sort of trouble. It would take a couple of days to repair the car, so Nancy and Hazel decided to take a jaunt south of the border to Juarez, Mexico. One day turned into five as the Packard underwent repairs and the ladies went back and forth across the border to kill time. Finally, on March 30th, the Packard was ready and the Fromms headed east from El Paso toward Dallas. The two women never made it. The next day the 50-cent Packard was found abandoned about 60 miles outside Van Horn, Texas, the sleepy county seat of Culberson County. The women were nowhere to be found and the only clue left behind in the car was a slashed spare tire that was missing its inner tube. Searchers combed the sparse region near the Big Bend area of the Rio Grande on foot, horseback, and plane for 3 days without luck. Then a long-distance trucker heard about the missing women and contacted the Texas Rangers. He thought that he had seen the Packard and a smaller car on the side of the road back a bit closer to Van Horn. The Rangers eventually found tire tracks matching the tires on the Packard running off into the brush. It wasn't long before they uncovered the bodies of the two women about a half mile off Route 80. "This cruel country is the perfect place for cruel murder," wrote Associated Press reporter Robert Johnson Jr. 15 years after the crime. "It is a land where only the Mexican eagle and the coyote feel at home." It was a cruel murder. The women both died from a gunshot wound to the temple fired from a Spanish-made .32, but each had been tortured before they were slain. Both mother and daughter were clothed only in their underwear, but neither had been raped. Nancy had been burned on each knuckle of her right hand by either cigarettes or cigars, and a couple of additional burns were seared into the back of her hand for good measure. She had apparently put up a good fight because black hair complete with roots was found clutched between her fingers, and skin and blood were caked beneath her nails. The bones and muscles in her abdomen were broken and torn as if someone had jumped hard on her stomach. In the hand with the hairs, Nancy also held a man's handkerchief embroidered with the letter F and a matchbook. Hazel was also brutalized. She had been beaten and a chunk of flesh was torn from her arm. At first it appeared that robbery was the motive for the murders because some jewelry and cash had been stolen from each woman. However, the killer or killers left equally valuable jewelry that was in plain sight. The Rangers believed that the Fromms were killed by more than one person based on several accounts given by witnesses. The best lead came from the truck driver who was able to describe both the other car seen with the Packard and the couple who it apparently belonged to. The sighting stuck in his mind because he had been passed by the Packard and a blue coupe that appeared to be traveling together. The cars pulled ahead of him and several miles later apparently doubled back, passing the trucker a second time. He told investigators that one woman was driving the Packard and a man and two women were riding in the blue coupe. The Fromm murder hit the news wires and was prominently reported across the country. A $10,000 reward for information leading to arrests prompted hundreds of tipsters to contact the Texas Rangers, who dutifully ran down each and every fruitless lead. Eventually the case file filled three drawers of a filing cabinet. Only one tip really helped the case, and it was only good enough to give authorities another theory for the motive. Around the same time that the Fromm Packard was being repaired in El Paso, a similar Packard was seen roaming around Van Horn. The informant believed that the occupants of that car were involved in smuggling narcotics from Mexico. Although that information never led anywhere, it did seem to make sense. Was it possible that a drug dealer was expecting a shipment smuggled inside the spare tire of a Packard? Perhaps that dealer thought Nancy and her mother were trying some kind of double cross and tortured them to get them to tell him where the drugs were hidden. If so, the women died because they were unable to tell what they didn't know. Buying a raffle ticket for a chance to win a car is a risky wager, but it's a safe bet we'll never know who killed Hazel and Nancy Fromm or why. A Tinsel Town Murder.
Good night, sweet dreams. Tomorrow's another day. Till then, sweet dreams, sweetheart. Good night, sleep tight. I'll see you along the way in dreams, sweet dreams.
A little more than 2 years before Elizabeth Short, better known as the Black Dahlia, was found dismembered in a Hollywood field, an equally mysterious Tinseltown murder occurred that, like the Dahlia slaying, remains unsolved to this day. Beyond the coincidence that the murders occurred in Hollywood in the 1940s and both victims were young, attractive women in their 20s, there is little in common between the brutal killing of the Dahlia and the death of Georgette Bauerdorf. Elizabeth's naked body was found hacked into pieces and reassembled in a vacant lot. She had been sexually assaulted before and after death. Georgette's partially dressed body was found face down in the bathtub of her upscale Hollywood apartment. She had not drowned, a cloth had been shoved 4 inches down her throat, and she had asphyxiated. Georgette had been sexually intimate prior to her death. The medical examiner did not report that the activity was not consensual, but other signs at the scene of her death indicated the sex was at least rather rough. Both women left clues behind that they had dates or appointments with mysterious men. Just who Elizabeth Short was going to meet is unknown, while Georgette, a compulsive diarist, recorded that she had an appointment on October 11, 1944, the evening before she was discovered dead, with a man known only as Mr. Wade. Separating fact from fiction as far as a legend like the Dahlia is concerned is difficult at best. Suffice to say that like many young women caught up in the big city lifestyle, the Dahlia probably was at least exposed to a bit of sordid behavior. Conversely, 20-year-old Georgette was the beloved daughter of a well-to-do family that made its money from oil and mining. She was living in a duplex in West Hollywood while she worked as a junior hostess at the USO Hollywood Canteen. It was Georgette's charity to servicemen that Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies said contributed to her death. She was accustomed to giving rides to soldiers and sailors and even loaned them money, friends said. Although Georgette adhered to the canteen's rules against leaving the nightclub with servicemen, she did occasionally date soldiers that she met at work. She had the means to do it and was interested in servicemen, said her father's secretary, Rose Gilbert. She used to show them the sights and foot the bills. Gilbert said Georgette refused to let the soldiers squander their meager $50 monthly pay on her. Some of the soldiers, apparently, were welcome in her apartment, based on a myriad fingerprints found in the place after her death. She had lots of dates, but I know for a fact that she made it a practice never to admit a man to her apartment unless there were others present, said her best friend, June Ziegler. June recalled that Georgette was an outgoing yet flighty young lady who was frequently misplacing her keys and other valuables, and who didn't think twice about leaving her purse in her car parked at the curb outside her apartment. On Wednesday, October 11, 1944, Georgette was planning to head to El Paso to watch the graduation of a friend from airman training at Fort Bliss on October 13. She purchased a $175 round-trip plane ticket that morning, did some shopping and got her hair done. She recorded in her diary that she was going to meet June at the canteen that night. Georgette and June arrived at the nightclub at 6:30 p.m. It is possible that shortly before meeting June, Georgette gave a ride along Sunset Boulevard to Army Air Corps Sergeant Gordon Ardland, who was in town from his base at Boeing Field in Seattle. The girl was nervous, Ardland told police after he learned of Georgette's murder. June agreed that Georgette was acting strangely that night. Georgette said she was nervous, but she didn't say why, June told police. She asked me to spend the night, but I couldn't do it. At the canteen, Georgette was pestered by Cosmo Volpi, a cheerful army sergeant who liked to jitterbug. He continually asked Georgette to dance, not realizing that she did not like the jitterbug. He kept cutting in on her all the time and forcing her to dance the jitterbug, June told police. But she danced with him so as not to make trouble. The women left the club around 10:30 p.m., with June heading for her home in Eagle Rock. As far as June knew, Georgette planned to drive home to her apartment on Fountain Avenue. Sometime between 10:30 p.m. and 4 the next morning, Georgette had a snack of cantaloupe and green beans. The rind of the fruit was found in the trash of her apartment and dirty dishes were in the sink, indicating that she ate the snack at home. The maintenance man, who lived in a basement apartment below Georgette, told police that he was awakened by a noise at midnight. It sounded like a woman's high heels clicking back and forth on the kitchen floor upstairs, Fred Atwood told police. A little later there was a crash as if somebody dropped a tray or something. Then everything was quiet. Another neighbor told authorities that he heard Georgette shriek, "Stop! Stop! You are killing me!" Around 2:30. "I heard a woman let out a scream that made me sit right up in bed," he said. Such screams were highly unusual in the apartments, but the man, at the time unsure if he had simply dreamed the cries, rolled over and went back to sleep. At 11 o'clock on Thursday morning, Lulu Atwood, wife of the maintenance man, noticed that the door to Georgette's apartment was open. Along with her husband, she went inside to investigate. There, lying face down in the half-filled bathtub, was Georgette Bauerdorf. She was only wearing her pajama tops and had a cloth clutched in her teeth. At first, investigating officers wondered if she wasn't an epileptic who bit on the towel in the course of a seizure and then fallen into the tub and drowned. The examination, however, revealed that Georgette was not epileptic and that the carefully folded towel had been jammed down her throat to strangle her. The killer had scratched her face in the process. The only clues were the notation in her diary about an appointment on October 12th with Mr. Wade and the fact that the cloth in her throat was part of a bandage that was manufactured overseas before World War II. Although that type of bandage was not American, police wondered if an American GI hadn't brought one home from abroad. Neither clue ever panned out, however. Georgette's bedroom was mussed, but showed little signs of any struggle. Her pink pajama bottoms lay at the foot of the bed and were badly torn. Some investigators believed that the pants were torn when her assailant pulled them from Georgette's body, while others believed that the tears were old. In the vestibule outside her apartment, police discovered that the light bulb had been loosened from its socket. The bulb was not burned out, but it would not light when the switch was thrown. A single fingerprint was found on the light bulb. Georgette's car was also missing. It was discovered later more than 10 miles away, its gas tank empty and the keys dangling in the ignition. Fingerprints on the light bulb and in the car did not match any known criminal or serviceman, authorities said. When news of Georgette's murder became known, Volpi, the jitterbugging sergeant, voluntarily appeared at police headquarters. He admitted monopolizing Georgette's time that night, but was found to have been back on base long before Georgette was killed. The case went cold and was filed away until 1947 when Elizabeth Short turned up dead in that Hollywood field. But none of the clues from Georgette's killing helped investigators looking at the Black Dahlia murder, and nothing in that investigation ever led to any developments in Georgette's murder. The case remains open.
We hope you have enjoyed this edition of the Malefactors Register podcast. These true crime stories were written by Mark Gribben and read by Peter Gray. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Barnes and certain musical selections were composed by Justin R. Urban. I'm Rachel Johnson. For more true crime stories on the web, visit markgribben.com. This podcast is copyright 2011 and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the copyright holder. Until next time, goodbye.